This is the beginning of Esoteric Astrology Adventure 157D, page 668. We've been talking about the resolution of different planets, planetary schemes, into each other. As I've sometimes tried to say, what if Pluto goes into Mars? What if Mars goes into, well, Earth is Earth. What if Earth goes into Venus? And Venus might be carried directly into Neptune. Or all of these, Earth might not resolve into Venus, and they might all go into Saturn here, including Vulcan and Jupiter eventually, all into Saturn, except for Mercury, which could go directly into Uranus, or wait until Saturn is absorbed into Uranus, and Venus go directly into Neptune, or a remote possibility, wait until the entire Jupiter, until the entire Saturn scheme, interestingly a hexagon here, with one in the center, the entire Saturn scheme goes into Uranus and thence into Neptune. Well, I don't think we should become too impatient about it, as if the Hindu chronology is correct, we have some trillions of years ahead of us before this happens. Not necessarily 151 trillion or 150 trillion. Let's say our solar system lasts 300 trillion, 311 trillion. We're halfway through. But there's a whole and long stage of appropriation which precedes the appearance of the physical vehicle. Now, we could make an analogy and say if we could figure out how long it takes the human body, well, the human being, to appropriate the inner vehicles before manifesting as a physical being, and how long it takes in the inner worlds after death to return to the causal body, we might be able to analogize those figures. I mean, you know, it's hopeless. Okay, but just bear with me. Analogize those figures into the span of 300 trillion years. Find the proportion of the whole of each one of those human cycles. The life cycle lasts 70 years. How long does appropriation last? How long does the period of return before return to the causal body last? What is the proportion? The physical life cycle, I think I'd make a general statement, is a small proportion compared to all the other cycles in the descent and reascent of the reincarnating human unit. So maybe, you know, out of all those trillions of years, a lot of them are spent on the inner planes and are not spent in relation to the visible solar system at all. And we're talking about now the disappearance of the visible physical planets by the absorption of their subtle principles. So somehow all of this absorption business has got to at least begin during that smaller segment, which is the duration of the solar system compared to the duration of the other cycles in the life cycle of a solar logos. So all this is to say we probably don't have to wait 150 trillion years. It'll be much shorter, I would say, but still, apparently, according to the chronology, numbered in the trillions. So anyway, it's not anything to get impatient about. But we could, of course, look at our own incarnation and our own death and our own pattern of absorption, and we could wonder whether certain behaviors prompted by certain centers have not been absorbed by higher centers. Like, for instance, maybe when we're young, we're full of desire. We want all kinds of things. We're always outgoing. Maybe that fades in a way. Of course, it won't be till the very last minute, then, in a sense that right before death, the energy will leave the chakras and they will sort of disappear because they are whirlpools, and will be left with fewer chakras, stimulating the, at least on the physical plane, at least their effect. Well, that's interesting. I mean, we still have astral chakras, of course. The etheric body doesn't last very long. Does it exit the body with a full set of chakras? Or is this the withdrawing, 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 so that there is no really vorticular motion anymore in certain parts of the body? But anyway, even at later stages of life, a lot of energy may have been drawn off from the solar plexus to the heart. It's not really like the disappearance of a chakra, but it's like quieting down. It's a kind of absorption, isn't it? A lot of the sacral may have gone to the throat, a kind of absorption, right? So we're living in our higher centers, and maybe we don't care so much whether we in a body survive, as that the good of the whole, according to the purpose, is enacted. And that would be the transference from the base to the head. So the gradual transference of energy from the chakras, lower chakras to higher chakras, is an anticipation of the moment of death when all the energy is transferred from the lower to the higher and eventually just into the head itself. And the question remains, is there any maintenance level of chakric activity going into the escaping etheric body, or is it pretty much all directed from the head until the dissipation of the etheric body, which is quite soon after death, maybe 10, maybe 3 days? That's the figure that often occurs or is suggested. Of course, as long as there's a monad, there will be chakras, because the chakras come from the vorticular motion of the monad, from the activity aspect, the phohatic activity, I believe, of the monad. So we'll have the astral chakras, and they will gradually disappear, and then we'll have the mental chakras, and of course we're not going beyond the causal body, but as the vehicles are coordinated, the buddhic and atmic vehicles are coordinated, we're going to have vorticular activity in those vehicles, chakras in those vehicles, even though they're not given, because 35 vortices make the master. Well, that was a bit of a digression. Doesn't seem like we got into anything yet, but it was important. Sirius influences our entire solar system, as we have discussed this. Via the three planets, and maybe the planet Isis, you know, as I've said before. We've discussed that. Saturn is the focal point for the transmission of cosmic mind to our entire seven planetary schemes. And what is the implication here? Implication is that there is a triangle between Pleiades, Saturn, and any heavenly man. Now you kind of wonder, how does it work? Maybe it's Pleiades straight to Saturn. So we have learned that the heavenly men give maybe more than they receive, or at least they give something, because the Pleiades are negatively polarized to them. But obviously there is a nurturing and a cultivation of mind. Of mind by the Pleiades for the heavenly men. What that relationship is, we don't exactly know. You know, in one way we say, well, the Pleiades give mind to the heavenly men, and Sirius gives mind to the solar logos. Well, no problem there. But it's in that return flow of the negative polarization of the Pleiades that we have our problem. Exactly what is going on in that exchange? But let's just say Saturn is a very monastic planet. Like I say, it probably has that double third ray, because we know it has the third ray monad, and there has to be sacred planets on every ray, and only Saturn is left. So it's got to have the double third ray. Stephen Pugh was right in that, I think. We're going back now 20 years or more when we were speculating upon this. So our entire seven planetary schemes, are we talking about esoteric Saturn being the recipient here in some way? And in a way, this greater whole being the transmitter of Manus to all of these, including Saturn itself? I don't think we have to know that for sure. Suffice it to say, the monastic connection of Saturn is very strong. That's why the atmic plane is really a monastic plane in a higher sense, because Saturn rules the monastic plane. Everything having to do with Manus is really exoteric relative to the two more esoteric aspects. The five planes are exoteric compared to the esoteric nature of plane two and plane one. The Saturn scheme is esoterically regarded as having absorbed the frictional fires of solar space. Well, this we discussed. Let's say that finally, the lives in whom solar systemic fire by friction is dominant will be absorbed in Saturn. And the lives in whom, because, you know, solar space is the space in which our solar logos has his manifestation. And so Neptune will absorb those lives in whom solar fire is dominant. And Uranus will absorb probably fewer lives in whom electric fire is dominant. All have to be absorbed. And maybe, you know, there is a term of attainment or a level of attainment for each of these kinds of lives. I mean, think of it. The human beings of the previous solar system attained humanity in the previous solar system and were transferred to this solar system as human beings. And thus it may well be for different kinds of representatives of the kingdoms of nature. They will be transferred to the next solar system as they are when the period of absorption comes upon them. So there will be three orders of lives, or let's see, three types of lives in general, three types in which one or other of the fires, fire by friction, solar fire, or electric fire, dominate. And they will be, if they are intra-systemic lives, they will be transferred to one of the three synthesizing planets that is the home of that particular kind of fire. See, the word home is monadic. And we know that Uranus is the home of electric fire. But we could say that Saturn is the home of fire by friction and Neptune the home of solar fire. The repository of the solar flames, as it is called. Now, is that only at the end, or does Neptune have some special connection with the heart of the sun? I keep on thinking, you know, a triangle, heart of the sun, Venus, Neptune. I think that Neptune has that solar fire tendency all the way through. But in terms of being one of the final absorbers, the kind of absorption we're talking about occurs at the period of synthesis on the way to the end of the solar system. Well, here is the sun. It's not a planet, is it? But in astrology, and people laugh at us, you know, as astrologers, they think the sun is a planet, you know. But it's one of the lights. And the sun is the central star, not a planet, of course, right? But it's sometimes treated in a planetary sense around the human ego. Here we stand, the lesser human ego at the center of our chart, and everything revolves around us, including the sun. So the sun can be planetary, which means it has a revolution. Therefore, when it is included among the planets, as it is simply because it stands for or veils a hidden planet. And it does, apparently. I've talked about the possibility of Adonis. I'm not sure, of course. A non-sacred planet of the second ray, and also Vulcan, Neptune, and Uranus. But also, maybe, Jupiter. There is a place where the sun and Jupiter, I should really memorize that page number. I always want to go back and get it, but Jupiter and the sun. I mean, I could try to look that up, you know. I get a little bit trapped in this looking up here. But we can see, going back to it, it's a good place to remember. And maybe we can find something. Sun veils Jupiter. Well, maybe this is it. Upon the cardinal cross, it is the, well, maybe that's it. Maybe I really got lucky here. Upon the cardinal cross, it is the central spiritual sun, which is called into play, and Uranus is then the distributing agency. And the head center becomes the center in the initiate's body through which direction and control come. In conjunction with the mutable cross, the rays of the sun in a threefold form, combining the lowest energies of the threefold sun, pour into and through the man via Jupiter. Jupiter is the agent of the second ray, which the sun expresses cosmically and systemically. That may be the rather oblique reference which I'm referring to. Jupiter is the agent of the second ray. It seems that if we're talking about Leo and the sun, we know that Uranus is veiled by the sun in relation to Leo. Well, maybe in relation to Leo as well, when we're thinking about the mutable cross experience, that Jupiter is veiled by the sun. So it is really an interesting statement. And what is the page number? I wonder if I've... No, I haven't been so good at getting the page number here. Well, I think I could find that page number pretty quick. In the rays of the sun in a threefold form. That's what I'll copy. Okay, let's try that. And it would be page 297. Oh, okay, and there's more to it, isn't it? I wonder why I didn't... This whole thing should be copied. It seems to suggest a physical sun, heart of the sun, central spiritual sun connection, and it implies how important Jupiter is in relation to Leo. I'll copy that whole business, and that is on page 297. So, here we go. And this is Esoteric Astrology 297. And let's say about it, we'll call it Sun Veils, Veiling, Jupiter, and Leo. Yes, that would be the way to look at it. And perhaps there is a big hint there. Upon the mutable cross, it is the physical sun and its influences which affect the man. But then we're told the rays of the sun in a threefold form, combining the lowest energies of the threefold sun, pour into and through the man via Jupiter. Jupiter is the agent of the second ray which the sun expresses cosmically and systemically, which makes me conclude, of course, that when considering the seven solar systems, of which ours is one, Jupiter is the planet in our solar system in closest relation to our particular sun, and Venus, the planet in our solar system, in closest relation to Sirius. And maybe, I'm just guessing here, but Mercury could be the planet in our solar system in closest relation to Procyon. I'm looking for sacred planets now, with its speed and its eagerness. So Mercury and the lesser dog, and Venus and the greater dog. Then we'd have to go on to other planets. If Venus is most closely related to Sirius, then Sirius does have to play the role of a Ajna center. You know, I've been puzzling over that, as you know. We have possibly, at least Nicholas thinks so, Vega and Altair to be considered as well. Peter Kabaska thinks that Epsilon of Eridanus should be found in our seven solar systems. There's differing opinion. But Venus is always the Ajna center for man. And so if Venus is in closest relationship to Sirius, is Sirius then the Ajna center in the seven solar systems, of which ours is one? Vega is related to the throat. Is Saturn's, Vega is in Capricorn, well, in Capricorn at the present time. Is Saturn the planet in our solar system in closest relation to Vega? In a way, their qualities don't seem similar. Vega is the strongest of all. Well, anyway, that leads me off onto a tangent. The question is, within the seven solar systems, of which ours is one, which are these one or maybe two-star solar systems, what is the role of Sirius? Now, sometimes we might call that the Sirian system, and it can connect with a head center. We've seen on page 301 that there is connection of Sirius with the head center. Then is Vega somehow the throat center because of its magical incantation? What would be the head center then? Vega and Sirius are the two most powerful stars. We have Altair, is that the base of the spine? Because it rises like the eagle, eventually. Fomalo, the solar plexus center. Alpha or Beta Centauri, maybe both, the sacral center. I seem to want to, Sun the heart for sure, I seem to want to make an assignment there, but we can't be sure. It's the relationship of Vega to our solar system. It seems to gravitate towards it. But surely I'm off on another tangent, am I not? So in our seven solar systems, how can we assign the stars? Can we say, I've always liked this, Altair, base of spine. Our solar system is not that advanced that a more powerful star would be the base of the spine. Alpha and Beta Centauri. The Sacrocenter. Fomalhaut. Well, better look it up now. I think we're not going to find it there. I'd like to spell it correctly, wouldn't you? So, okay, I'm close. Fomalo. The solar plexus. But we can't be sure whether Fomalo is really one of the stars. It is one of the royal stars. How many royal stars should we include? Maybe that's because of its visual magnitude relative to the Earth and because it's on a great cross. We're not going to be including here Antares, vast star, or Aldebaran, or Regulus, Fomalo and Heart, or we'll say Sol, or Helios, Heart, Center, and maybe Vega. I'm going to wonder about that. Vega, Throat Center, because its magical incantation is very strong with that. And maybe Procyon, Agna, and then maybe Sirius, Head Center. No, I can't get it straight. And this would be on Esoteric Astrology 301, the reference which shows Sirius in relation to the head center. This is possible. Okay. So the Sun stands for hidden planet, and this is some... so then, if this is the case, if this is the case, we can call the seven solar systems by the name the Sirian system. But when looked at in the context of a cosmic logos, could Sirius A and Sirius B undertake to be the two centers, higher and lower, in the solar plexus center as a whole, with all the rest of the stars being lower centers? Or would it be Sirius and our Sirius and our sun? See, because we're talking about, from the point of view of the one about whom naught may be said, Sirius is just a member of the solar plexus, and maybe Sirius B too. And our sun, though in a way a heart, even though Sirius is, let's say, a head center in this cosmic logos, which is the solar plexus and the one about whom naught may be said, though Sirius is a head center, it still could be considered the foremost and highest center or point in that solar plexus center from the perspective of the one about whom naught may be said. And maybe Sirius B is involved there, since the two, you have to look for a two-ness, and it's a dual system. And you might want to assign it to the absent center because of its duality, but it's a bit small. So is Sirius B. But for solar plexus, I think it fits well. And there are two points within the solar plexus analogizing from the idea that what exists in man may exist in the stars. We may be, the correspondence may not be exact, but maybe it is. There are these dualities. If we can find the astrological factors which take the place of the dualities, or which are uphold a position in the dualities, like the two centers in the solar plexus, okay, then we have a duality called the mental unit and the monastic permanent atom. Then we have a duality in the two leaves of the Agnes Center. So if we can find which ones of these astrological factors uphold a position within these dualities, we will have learned a lot. Like some have said, well, Sirius is too, so it's got to be the Agnes Center, forgetting that in the solar plexus, that duality also exists. That's something, I think, to reckon with. Okay. The sun is merely one of those suns which are sunflowers of a higher light, a cosmic logos. It is dwelling in the vehicle of a god or of a host of gods like myriads of other suns. The vehicle of a god, well, locally, the cosmic logos, our cosmic logos, and a little more remotely, the super constellational logos, or one about whom? Oop, one would assume that's not it. One about whom? Oh, come on. Of a host of gods, like myriads of other suns. Well, this is a really, what would we say here? A very decentralizing statement, wouldn't you say? You know, we have been anthropocentric, we have been geocentric. We tend to be heliocentric, but even heliocentrism has to be sacrificed eventually. One day, great beings will be talking and say, well, that's just the galactocentric point of view. If we really decentralize ourselves from our galaxy, what will be the perspective? So one day, there will be the universal logos all in all. And we'll say, well, this is how things are. Well, in this universe, which the universal logos has become. But the universal logo said, well, I'm not really the center of things. I'm not the point. We better merge into that which is truly pointless and sacrifice the point which we think we are. And that will be the return to the all-absorbent, which no name suffices to describe. The sun is the storehouse of the force, which is the noumenon of electricity. So even though the sun dispenses solar fire, this solar fire is the basis of all the modes of electricity in our solar system. So a noumenon is that from which all things come, or the essential archetype, or the prototype, or the higher pattern of that which appears. Without the noumenon, the phenomenon would not occur. Phenomenon is what is visible for us. So, in a way, even though Uranus is the home of electric fire, and maybe Neptune the home of solar fire, maybe Saturn the home of fire by friction, the sun is the final home of all of these demonstrations of electricity. So we say the sun is the final home of all systemic demonstrations of electricity. The sun was not a sacred planet. You know, it's rather bizarre. If you look at this statement and you haven't studied esoteric astrology, what in the world would you assume? But here we realize the sun as a veil of a non-sacred planet on the second ray is symbolically not a sacred planet. We'll learn more about what that planet might be. Sometimes I've wondered, you know, well, Isis seems just too far out, and also too important, because it is somehow a distributor. It's a bit like a past master in a Masonic lodge. It's a supervisor. It's a distributor of Sirian force. At least that undiscovered planet is this distributor of Sirian force to our three synthesizing planets. Must be a pretty powerful planet to receive a direct stimulation from Sirius. Maybe for this non-sacred secondary planet, you see, it wouldn't make sense, would it, that a non-sacred secondary planet would receive the Sirian stream and then trifurcate it into three streams for our three most powerful planets. I don't think a lesser deity could do that. But I'm wondering if in our solar system there are not only, of all the many, many planets out there, if some of them are like past masters, almost like super sacred, you know. Not non-sacred, not sacred, not synthesizing, but of a very high caliber, super sacred in a way, remaining present in order to assist the workings of the solar lodge, as it were. That's what a past master does. He has been through it all, and he advises the one who is the present master. So, just to remind myself, it may be a foolish idea, but, you know, just to remind myself, I'm going to say that is a planet like the HYPL, hypothetical planet, Isis, a super sacred planet like a past master, in capitals, in a lodge. In this case, the solar lodge. Okay. The sun has its growth, changes, development, and gradual evolution. This would not be a common thought, of course, but the sun is a logos, on his way, is on the path of the solar logoi, and is not yet, as we have read, not yet mentally polarized in the cosmic sense. Not yet an initiate of the third degree. Must become an initiate of the fourth cosmic degree in this solar system. So, of course, the sun is on its way, and, you know, when we think about what happens in our solar system and how the sun might affect the Earth, we think of an inanimate heavenly body. But this is not the case. This is a great deity who's going through changes and whose chakras have to be employed in the changes that he is going through, and hence Earth will be affected, as it is one of the chakras of this solar logos. So this seems obvious to us who have studied occultism. The sun is matter and the sun is spirit. Well, this is for people who know, those who know about the heart of the sun and the central spiritual sun will attest to this. Or should we say attest to the accuracy of this. So we've been talking about the lower energies, you know, the pranic energies, the energies of the physical sun, even though they are high compared with the energies of a physical planet. And in a way, the material body of the solar logos consists of three planes. Material body of the solar logos consists of three planes. So when we talk about the astral energy of the solar logos, not just his etheric and physical energy, which is found in the solar system. Well, the astral and mental energy are part of his personality, but they are not his physical body. The material physical body of the solar world consists of three systemic planes. Okay, these three systemic planes are our etheric physical, astral, and mental, systemically considered. So that's all these three planes are matter from the point of view of the solar logos, i.e. Low matter, not etheric matter. So the sun is matter of an etheric physical systemic kind, you know, our ethers, and maybe the gaseous is the most dense part. We're not going to have liquid and mineral per se. It may all have been reduced to gas in the lowest physical part. But that etheric physical systemic vehicle is really part of a dense physical vehicle, which also includes our astral plane and our lower mental plane, even our mental plane entirely. All that is matter from the point of view of the solar logos. The sun is a great magnet. On the second ray, a major ray of magnetism, an attractive ray. So what does it do? It magnetizes all the heavenly bodies in our solar system and holds also the other lives, which are not planetary in nature. So it is the attractive force, that which draws into itself, is the energy of the second ray. We've been talking about that kind of will. I wonder if we would find that here. Draws into itself, or maybe just draw into itself. Draw into. I'm not doing so well. The fire that I create must heat, not burn. It must draw into its warmth. Well, that is true. Attractive power will draw into a coherent, and it will draw into itself. See, the cosmic principle of love. What do we have here? Love is an aspect of the will, which is a point very little realized by the mass of men. It is the will to draw into itself, or the will to attract into itself, and this will, when exerted, well, that's it. That's exactly the quotation for which I was searching and which we dealt with not long ago in discussing the will on page 623. So let's quote that. I think it's important to remind ourselves non-sentimentally what love is. EA 620-23. And okay, we'll make it a little smaller. Love is an aspect of the will. So this is, you know, our solar logos is the solar locus of love. God is a consuming fire, and the fire of love in this case, love and wisdom, but very much an astral Buddhic solar logos. So if our solar logos was traveling a super cosmic path here, he would be more a lord of compassion than he would be a master of the wisdom. We'll see how he turns out. But as it stands right now, he seems more on the astro-Buddhic line, the cosmic astro-Buddhic line, and so would be not just the lord of compassion, but a cosmic lord of compassion. So, this is 623. Love is an aspect of the will, which is a point very little realized by the mass of men. It is the will to draw into itself or the will to attract into itself. And this will, when exerted towards that which is not material, we, in reaction to the differentiating mind, call love. So this says something about the great magnetism of our particular sun, which is a heart center. The heart is magnetic. So this tells us about the magnetism. Magnetism of our particular solar logos. Maybe all the solar logoi are magnetic, even the first ray. The first ray is said to be the real source of magnetism. And DK explains that. We usually consider it to be the second ray. But as we know, electricity and magnetism go hand in hand, and when the electric fire is asserted, let us say, the magnetic aspect appears. Okay. The solar substance is immaterial, and maybe what we're being told here is that the solar substance is more plasmic or even etheric than material in the conventional sense. I'll leave that to some scientists to work out, but I think that that's what we're speaking of. We're not talking about planetary substance in the condition in which, or we're not talking about planetary matter, not talking about planetary matter in the condition in which that matter exists on planets. Everything has been the constituency of the sun. Well, it's not only gaseous, it's also plasmic, and I believe also etheric. The question is, if ether is sufficiently intense, can it actually be seen by human eyes and telescopes? So the we will not have the usual liquid and dense mineral forms on the sun because of the very great intense heat. They will have been gasified, and even a more subtle form of matter will exist. So that's what we mean here by immaterial. The sun, that is the solar system, has Alcyone in the Pleiades for the center of its orbit. Such a, radical statement. Was it popular at the time of this writing in the Secret Doctrine? Well, very much depends on the accuracy of this statement. A lot of occultism, a monadic cycle of 250,000 years, is correlated with this revolution around the Pleiades. And if our sun revolves, as I've said, revolves, then it seems that its neighboring suns in the seven solar systems, of which ours is one, has also to revolve. So let's just say that neighboring suns, which are neighboring suns, like Sirius, Procyon, Alpha, Centauri, must also evolve. Otherwise, the integrity of the seven solar systems of which ours is one would be lost. Remember, I've explained that in two ways. Seven stellar systems or constellations of which our stellar system or constellation is one. One way to explain it. And another more ordinary way of explaining it, seven systems of one sun, maybe two suns, seven normal solar systems of which our normal solar system is one. So is this true? Now, if we're revolving around Alcyone, we might as well be revolving around all the Pleiades, because there's no way to revolve around Alcyone without revolving around them all. So distant they are, 400 light years, something like that. And how fast would our sun have to travel? I've asked one of my friends, Melvin, to figure this out. Given the light years from the sun and the 250,000 year span, how fast would our sun and maybe associated stars have to travel in the orbit in order to complete that cycle in 250,000 years, and is that speed unreasonable? I mean, if we find out that it's the speed of, I'll use a foolish example, but if we find out that it's the speed of light, something's wrong. In other words, what we know about the proper motion of our sun, or whatever kind of speed we can detect in relation to our sun as we check it out against the background of stars, each with their own proper motion, is the speed which we feel we are registering in those kinds of calculations comparable to the speed which would have to be achieved for our sun to travel around the Pleiades in 250,000 years? I could give that also to Jose Becerra, who is another fine astrologer whom I should have mentioned earlier. And he is a fine mathematician. So anyway, I'm just pondering how I shall do this. The logos with the seven hierarchies form one power. So in the word world of form, the sun and the seven chief planets constitute one active potency. So, the planets are chakras in the solar logos, and together they are one radiatory potency, mostly at this time on the second ray. So we have to realize, no matter what might be the ray of any planet, the pervasive second ray must always be considered as fundamentally conditioning. So each planet is considered as a hierarchy, each planetary logos and all associated lives. He's just stating the same fact in two ways. The logos with the seven hierarchies form one power. So in the world of form, the sun, see, he's looking at it spiritually, the logos and the hierarchies and the sun and the chief planets form one active potency. And this comes back to emanation theory in a way like this. Are the logoi of the planets really different from the logoi of the sun, logos of the sun? In other words, we have different identities, but we're all one thing. And the different identities don't really count when we're absorbed back into the one thing. That's part of harmlessness, isn't it? How does it go? Realization and esoteric experience and absorption into the whole. The foundations of harmlessness. So are the planetary logoi really part of the solar logos? And of course, it's not an independent being. Is it really part of the cosmic logos, which is not an independent being? Is it really part of the superconstellational logos, which is not really an independent thing? Is it part of the subparaparamonic logos, which is not an independent thing? Is it really part of the cosmic parabrahmic logos? All this, is it's on page 344. There it is. And here's our cosmic parabrahman. But the article A instead of the means there's more than one. And of course, it's just really, isn't it, a septinate, which septinate itself together is a septinate, and on until one really can't go any further according to the 10 dimensions of cosmos. The Sun, Moon, and Mercury were the earliest trinity of the Egyptians. Now we had Osiris, the Sun, okay? Isis, the Moon, and Hermes, of course, Mercury. We haven't encountered this one before. But Osiris, this is interesting. I'm going to make a little bit of an equation here, or an equivalence. Sun, let's see, Osiris, Sun, Osiris, Orion. Orion and Osiris are the same. Sun, second ray, heart. Isis and the Moon, well, the High Priestess, but veiling what planet? The Moon can veil. It veils many things. Does the Moon also veil the planet Isis? Out there, with a period around the Sun of approximately as many years as the Earth has days around the Sun, and Hermes. So isn't this, in a way, this Egyptian Trinity is Father, Mother, and Son? Of course, if Osiris is the Son as the Father, he's not the Son as the Son. Sun as the Father, Isis as the Mother, Hermes as the Son. That is how we can look at it. But Osiris, we have to look at the equivalence, examine the equivalence of Osiris and Orion. Whatever we can learn about Osiris, if it really is the Sun, it's the heart. But the Sun can also be considered the Father. But if Osiris and Orion are in some sense related to the S-O-N in a larger context, then maybe we have a justification for considering Orion to be the heart center of this superconstellation Logos. Still many things unanswered, right? All right, we are dealing with the Sun, right? And we'll come back to that because the Sun, of course, has many, many meanings, as we can see. Then we'll deal with Uranus, with Venus, Sirius, I guess. Maybe we dealt with Sirius already. Venus has a lot. And then Vulcan, a little bit. Capricorn. And cosmic fire will give us further knowledge. Yeah, it's not going to go fast. Not going to go fast. Rather slower, in a way, than the earlier parts of the book, because we're really, really into cosmic fire at this point. So this is page 750, or 6, excuse me, what am I talking about? This is page, how about knowing that? 670. Okay, so this is the end. Esoteric Astrology Adventure, page 670. Esoteric Astrology Adventure 157D, page 670. And beginning with Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 158A, page 670. Well, I think I'm there, friends. I think I've said enough now. Maybe more than enough. Too much. So we will then pick this up when I can. I'm pressing forward now. There are 25 pages left in the book. And I'd like to finish this, as Mary Bailey used to say, with all due deliberate speed. You can understand, you know, she was first ray soul. You can understand the control of the first ray upon the Mars speed function, which is rather impulsive and erratic. All due stabilized, controlled, Vulcanian, Saturnian, deliberate speed. Hopefully that will be within a few days. Okay, friends, we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.